Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Is it really possible that Akio Toyoda didn't know that sticky pedals were causing his best-selling car to sometimes race out of control? As it turns out, yes. Car analyst Paul Eisenstein says that at Toyota, employees didn't just hide bad news from the public, they even hid it from their own managers.
Really scary, though, is that what we're now seeing is a company that seems enmeshed in secrecy.
In hindsight, the automaker may now be wishing they had been less protected against bad news. In hindsight, Akio Toyoda probably wishes he could have avoided having to say this.
I myself, as well as Toyota, am not perfect. At times, we do find defects.
Sometimes, I guess, no news is really bad news. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 25th. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Celeste. It's good to be back.
We've missed you.
Yeah, I miss the Florida weather already, though.
You know, is this Toyota story? You know when your kids, something bad happens at school and you find out later that they didn't tell you and they say, well, I didn't want you to worry.
A lot of worrying going on at Toyota. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. In about 2 hours, President Obama and 22 influential lawmakers will lock themselves in a room at the Blair House for 6 hours and try to come up with common ground on health care reform. It'll all be televised, but no breakthroughs are expected. And Toyota President Akio Toyoda says he's moving forward.
Toyota's car is safe.
It's the message he tried to get across to Congress and the American public on Capitol Hill yesterday. And there was also this.
I am deeply sorry for any accident that Toyota drivers have experienced.
34 deaths have been linked to the Toyota safety lapses. The company's president insisted the problem is not, however, with the car's massive electronic systems throughout its product line.
For details on Toyota's testimony, we're joined now by Michael O'Brien, staff writer for The Hill. Michael, earlier this week, James Lentz, president of Toyota Motor Sales USA, told Congress that the solution to the acceleration problem would come from Japan. So did Akio Toyoda tell us how they're going to fix it?
Well, Mr. Toyota said his company's doing its best to fix their problems, but maybe not to the level of satisfaction that Congress was looking for.
But they said they have completely ruled out the electronic system as the cause.
Yes. Mr. Toyota said he's completely confident that the electrical systems are not to blame, although he did admit that they're really not sure what has caused them at this point, which spurred a level of frustration at yesterday's hearings.
Okay, stay with us, Michael O'Brien. We'll be back with you in a moment.
U.S. officials are calling it a new beginning, not mission accomplished for one city in Afghanistan. As several hundred residents looked on, the red, black, and green flag of Afghanistan was raised this morning over the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. NATO forces continue a mop-up operation in the city. Top U.S. Commander Stanley McChrystal told the Times of London yesterday, NATO forces will soon turn their attention to the province of Kandahar. Australia has summoned the Israeli ambassador to explain why three new suspects in the Dubai killing of a Hamas leader used Australian passports. The three, two men and a woman, were named after among 15 new suspects.
And a killer whale at Orlando's SeaWorld killed its trainer in front of a horrified audience yesterday. Witnesses say the 12,000-pound whale snatched the trainer off a platform by her waist, held her underwater in its jaws, and drowned her. And at the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 2-0. Canada gave Russia a good old-fashioned walloping. They won 7-3. Looking at the markets, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,374, the S&P at 11,105, and the Nasdaq at 2235.
Tech Thursday, we're going to talk about the conviction of three Google executives in Italy and what it means for internet free speech. Is there such a thing? And Frustration Nation continues. Our series is about what civics teachers are teaching students about American government in these days. Coming up next, we're going to talk more about Toyota facing a congressional panel and what the president has had to say. That in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Toyota's CEO Akio Toyoda testified on Capitol Hill yesterday.
Well, I didn't want to be him yesterday.
I haven't wanted to be him for a few weeks now.
Yikes.
Striking a very contrite and remorseful tone, Toyota stressed again his company's commitment to safe vehicles. He spoke in English in his opening remarks before he switched over to Japanese and used the services of an interpreter while lawmakers questioned him.
In the past few months, our customers have started to feel uncertain about the safety of Toyota's vehicle, and I take full responsibility for that.
Let's return now to Michael O'Brien, staff writer for The Hill. Michael, you were at yesterday's congressional hearings. The lawmakers were a little less confrontational. They pushed back a little bit less than we expected on Toyota. Is that because of language difficulties?
Yeah, the translation between Mr. Toyota and the congressman really sort of slowed down the pace of the hearing, allowed for maybe a less confrontational atmosphere. Still, it really got testy at points, and lawmakers were clear in showing their frustration at Mr. Toyota and Mr. Inaba.
Did Akio Toyota offer any new information, new details on the incident to kind of satisfy some of the questions and confusion that's been going on?
Well, yes and no. He said that, you know, because he had become CEO of the company in only June of 2009, he was only privy to some information. He said he first was aware of the acceleration problems in December of 2009, but lawmakers were a little skeptical of that. They wanted to know more about when the company was aware of its sudden acceleration problems.
And did he explain why that had been going on while he was president, but no one had told him for 6 or 7 months?
Right. It was Mr. Inaba who really fielded this a little bit more. He's the head of their North American operations. And what he blamed was sort of a diffuse infrastructure within the company that really hindered them from being able to connect the dots in their sudden acceleration problems in different lines across the world. So they're pledging a greater effort to try and coordinate their global brands and identify problems sooner.
Well, as you said, Toyota did not give any definitive answer as to what's causing sudden acceleration problems. I imagine not getting an answer to that question is not going to satisfy Congress. Michael O'Brien is a staff writer for The Hill. And I want to bring in now Deborah Hayden. She's the managing partner in Japan for Kreab Gavin Anderson. It's a corporate communications consultancy. Deborah, a lot has been written about the so-called the Toyota way. They have 14 guiding principles that have been actually emulated, copied by other corporations around the world. And in the Toyota way, they insist managers actually get out from behind their desks, go and see and solve problems at the source. But there's little in those principles that actually talks about communication coming from the ground up.
Hi, Celeste. No, that's certainly a very good point to start with. I think as in any crisis, it's always hard for bad news to move up a company. It certainly moves up very, very slowly. Your natural human reaction is to think, gosh, you know, is there something I can do to solve this myself before I, you know, at least bring a solution to my boss? And I think in Japan and in many other Asian countries, this is slightly compounded by the Confucian principles of respect for your superior. So, and we've got a society here where it's actually really difficult to actually bring up a problem to your boss where you actually don't know the answer. So I think that's probably one of the things that's played into the situation. I think another thing here too, and you mentioned the word communications, is that the way that communications sort of fits into, you know, business continuity planning and crisis planning in Japan is a little bit different. Certainly their business continuity plans, for example, if a generator breaks down, you know, how do you get the plant up and running again, you know, tried and tested to perfection. But the communications aspect of where this fits with, if there's a problem, is often a sort of a last-minute afterthought. It's like, oh, let's call in those PR folks and get them to give us a couple of bullet points about what we should do if someone calls us up. And I think compared to, say, companies in the West, particularly in a situation like Toyota, where, you know, you're making cars, which at the end of the day are products, if there is something that goes wrong, you know, people's lives are at stake. They should have been more prepared that something like this could happen, and that should have been not only a business continuity plan, but it also should have been a communications plan going right in lockstep of what do we do, who do we talk to, who are our key audiences, who are the right people to communicate this, and that should have been something that had been etched on people's brains, not sitting in a manual that was sort of gathering dust in the back of one of the cupboards.
And you may have really touched on what's really at heart here, because certainly this the recall of these cars, while tragic in their situations, is not extreme. Ford Motor Company actually holds the record for the most recalls of any automaker since we've been keeping records. But there was a mismanagement of the PR of this recall. There was a mismanagement not only over how they handled the problems when they first discovered them, but also how they handled the press when they were released to the public.
I think, we've had a very interesting situation here. Part of it goes back again to Japanese corporate culture, where there's, if you're, one of the company soldiers that has been there since you graduated from university, you're one of the insiders. And it's very important. It's like being part of a family. They'll look after you. You're part of a family. You've got, the guiding principles and the ethics to uphold. And so it's very hard for this group to actually admit outsiders. It's hard to have somebody come in who's not part of that inside group, for example, an outside consultant. It's hard to get a third perspective on some of the issues. Most large companies of a similar stature in the US, for example, would have an army of PR and kind of public relations and public affairs advisors who would be always on standby, who would know the company backwards, who would know, be ready to jump to an issue when it was needed. This isn't the case necessarily with many Japanese companies, and particularly not with Toyota.
Well, let me ask you about the corporate culture there. Having the most important CEO of the largest company in Japan called to answer to American lawmakers, is that an embarrassment for CEOs and executives and the corporations in Japan?
This is certainly, I think, a very unusual situation. It's the first time this has happened for Japanese companies. But, Japanese executives do get called into the Japanese equivalent of Congress, the Diet, from time to time to explain situations as well. I'm glad he went over. I'm glad he went and talked to Congress. And I'm glad that he's sort of standing at the head of the company and now communicating, which is, what he should be doing.
Okay, Deborah Hayden is a managing partner in Japan for the Kreab Gavin Anderson Company. It's a corporate communications consultancy. And we also spoke with Michael O'Brien, a staff writer for The Hill, talking about Akio Toyoda's appearance at a congressional hearing yesterday on Capitol Hill. And now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
Well, Senate Democrats delivered yesterday a major jobs bill. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says the bill includes an incentive for businesses to hire the unemployed.
It is a holiday from the payroll tax for any employer who hires a worker who has been out of work for 60 days.
The bill also includes an extension of state highway funding. Today, President Obama and members of Congress will weigh in on health care reform during a six-hour meeting that will be broadcast live on television. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell will be there.
If the White House wants real bipartisanship, then it needs to drop the proposal it posted Monday, which is no different in its essentials than anything we've seen before, and start all over.
Well, the healthcare reform meeting gets underway at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear it live at thetakeaway.org.
A big day at the Olympics today. 7 medal events scheduled, including women's ice hockey and freestyle men's skiing, both of which the U.S. has a chance to win. At the games yesterday, the U.S. took home 2 bronze medals. One of the winners was bobsled competitor Alana Myers.
We came in trying to stay calm, trying to stay relaxed and have a little fun, and that's what we did. All 4 runs were a blast. Every single run, I looked over Aaron and just had the biggest grin on my face.
And that's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll get a preview of the healthcare summit that we talked about and why some Republicans are already saying,
I don't see any reason to allow the president to have a 6-hour infomercial about his bill.
That is Senate Minority Leader John Boehner, and we're going to talk more about the healthcare summit and whether or not it will achieve bipartisanship in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Also, our first takeout. News unclear. Spectacle, it certainly will be. But the healthcare reform summit for 6 hours in Washington, convened by the White House, in the middle of a snowstorm, will it get anything done? That's really the question. And if you take House Minority Leader John Boehner as a guide, well...
I don't see any reason to allow the president to have a six-hour infomercial about his bill. And I have no problems going down there and pointing out what I believe the flaws in his bill are and outlining what we think are common sense steps to make our system work better.
Will they get anything done? Well, we thought we would ask former co-host of The Takeaway and currently Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who's back in the Capitol just in time for a snowstorm, whether they will get anything done on this summit. Good morning, Todd.
Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much. Thanks for filling in.
Sure. Oh, it was a pleasure. I had a great time, by the way. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, Todd.
So, John, the question, will they get anything done? I mean, from the sounds of John Boehner right there, it doesn't seem like they will. There are no signs going into this healthcare summit that there's going to be any form of substantive negotiation on a new plan going on. You know, earlier in the week we said that the White House introduced a new plan, sort of a plan by the president that really tilts heavily towards the Senate bill, and Republicans don't like that bill either. So while John Boehner says Republicans are, you know, they're calling this an infomercial and coming in really to point out the flaws in the president's plan, at the same time, Democrats are formulating a legislative strategy on their own, which is going to alienate Republicans even more. It's called reconciliation, and the bottom line is they can try to pass the president's sort of new bill with no Republican support whatsoever. You bypass the filibuster. It's not the first time it's ever been done. It's not unheard of, but it's not bipartisan. It's the furthest thing from bipartisan.
And it seems like it's been talked about a lot, but as an actual threat, leveraging this summit into some sort of actual meaningful debate, I think that's kind of unclear. But you'll be there, right, Todd?
Well, it's pooled coverage, so yeah. None of us will be in the room, but I'll be glued to the TV.
All right, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, talking about the healthcare summit convening in a couple of hours in Washington.
Our next takeout comes from the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. Amidst some foggy, snowy conditions yesterday, disaster on the ski slopes, at least for the Americans.
Oh, that looked Lindsey Vonn right in the center of that gate. Looked like she caught an edge and rockets into the fencing down there.
That was NBC's broadcast of Lindsey Vonn crashing during the giant slalom. Not only did she end up with a broken finger, but her crash also disrupted her teammate Julia Mancuso's run. Here to explain is Jason Stallman from our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
First of all, how did Lindsey crash?
Just a really strange scene up at Whistler. She was having a great run on the giant slalom, but the conditions were just treacherous, really foggy, snow blowing all over the place. She was having a strong run about two-thirds of the way through, about 150 yards from the finish line. Her left ski just kind of came out from under her, and she went down pretty hard, slid into the fencing around the course, and she was out.
And clearly that was a problem for her run, but how did it affect Julia Mancuso's run?
Yeah, really unusual turn of events. What happened was, because the course officials were trying to expedite the race, they let Mancuso start before Vonn was finished. That's somewhat uncommon. So Mancuso had started her run. They had to wave the yellow flag about halfway down and take her up on a snowmobile back to do a rerun, is what they call it, and she was distraught. She was really, really emotionally upset because she knew that the conditions were only getting worse, and she wanted to get her run in as soon as possible. She ended up finishing 18th off that first run.
Well, that's too bad. But we had news not just in skiing yesterday, but in hockey as well. Both the U.S. and Canadian teams have advanced to the semifinals.
Boy, did they. I should probably apologize up front if there's too much background noise here, because my hotel happens to be on Robson Street, the heart of downtown Vancouver. And I don't know, but what is it, 10, 12 hours after the Canada-Russia game, there's still hundreds, if not thousands, of people celebrating out on Robson. It's a pretty nutty scene here. They treated it like a gold medal game. It really does seem like Canada just won a gold in hockey after destroying Russia 7-3. Meanwhile, the United States gets past Switzerland in a really close game. They won 2-0. So Canada and the United States on to the semifinals.
Pretty exciting. Okay, thanks so much, Jason. Jason is the Olympics editor, Jason Stallman, for our partner, The New York Times. And now, a sports takeout that's not from the Olympics. The NCAA sent a letter to the University University of Michigan. They've accused the school of major rules violations. One of the charges is that Michigan is accused of making this athlete's practice more than the requisite 8 hours a week. But that's just one of several charges. Here to explain is Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The NCAA has launched this investigation. This was after months of looking into the problem. And it looks like now they've said, yes, you committed major rules violations. So what happens now?
So let's peel back a little bit. College football players, they practice about 25 to 30 hours per week in season. Then out of season, that reduces considerably, and that's where that 8 hours comes from per week. So you have all these players off season. It's the calm time of the year, and they're being still drilled pretty heavily. Michigan hasn't had a winning season in two seasons, so now the coach is really driving them hard to try and force them essentially to win. So that's where this is the context that this is coming under, that you have all these players that have to prove themselves and a coach that has to prove himself, so they're driving them practicing too hard to do it.
Right, but they've violated the rules, and I guess the big question here is whether or not they did it intentionally or whether, as Michigan claims, it was an accident. So the NCAA is going to come back with their findings in 90 days, I guess, but that's right as the football season is getting geared up.
Exactly. So they didn't accurately report how many hours that they were practicing, and that is the issue here, is what is the system of reporting of the hours of practice. Now, if they actually get some sanctions, the question is, are they going to do self-imposed sanctions within Michigan, or are they going to have the NCAA impose the sanctions themselves? To me, it's kind of like getting an industry that's faulty, maybe the car industry, regulating itself. I'm not sure if Michigan is the best person to regulate themselves. I think that the NCAA should step in and do a more thorough audit.
Well, it could end up eventually, conceivably, with a bowl ban for the University of Michigan, one of the most winning football programs in the country. Thanks so much. That's Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. More in our series, Frustration Nation and the Gridlock in Washington. It's coming up.
Coming up, we check in with a high school civics teacher and some high school students in Frustration Nation looking for teachable moments in what's going on in Washington right now. But let's check in on some of the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, a single U.S. general is calling it a new beginning. As several hundred residents looked on, the Afghan flag was raised this morning over the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay says NATO troops are still sweeping the city.
Some insurgents do not want to reintegrate, do not want to reconcile, and we're going to have to permanently push them off.
Meanwhile, top U.S. Commander Stanley McChrystal told the Times of London yesterday that NATO forces will soon turn their attention to the province of Kandahar.
Here at home, a former New Orleans policeman has pleaded guilty to covering for officers who killed two men in the chaos following Hurricane Katrina. The shootings happened 6 days after the storm, when police are accused of firing at unarmed people crossing a bridge in search of food. Education Secretary Arne Duncan is applauding the move to fire every single teacher at a Rhode Island high school. The firings, effective at the end of the school year, came after the district failed to reach an agreement with the teachers' union on a plan to improve lagging test scores. Deborah Gist is the Rhode Island Education Commissioner.
We will not have schools in our state who year after year after year fail to serve children well.
The union plans to fight the decision. And Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke isn't giving any clues as to when interest may be increased. He said we can expect unemployment, though, to decline at a very slow rate over the next couple of years. Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,374. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the Nasdaq starts at 2,235. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry, and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
So our Frustration Nation segment this morning begins with a question to you. Listen to this voice and see if you can hear, is it hope or is it just giving up?
There's so much going on in Washington right now and so much not getting done.
I feel like future generations and the people right now have a great opportunity to step up and change it, and it just makes me want to get more involved and have my voice heard.
Punt the whole business to future generations, or is that hope of young people looking at the situation in Washington and trying to figure out how their government actually works? That's Danielle Rodillo, who's a senior at Howell High School in Michigan. And we thought we'd extend that conversation and get some voices who can actually answer some of those questions. Alan Broadman joins us. He's a civics teacher at East Brunswick High School in New Jersey. He joins us from his home. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
Michael Head is also with us. He's a senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And a junior at Detroit School of the Arts is Amina Green, who joins us from Detroit. Good morning, Amina.
Good morning.
All right, Alan, first of all, you know, as I was thinking about talking to you this morning, not only do you have an enormous set of lessons from the last few months in Washington, but if you go back to the election, I mean, you've gone from a peak of hope and a sense of possibilities with the election in 2008 to something very, very different right now. Explain briefly how that arc affects what you teach as a civics teacher.
Well, it's one of the interesting things when you think about it, and it's a wonderful civics lesson because it distinguishes between what an election is and then what running a government is. And those are two very distinctly different things. And it's a wonderful perspective for the students to understand that. It's also frustrating because they don't fully grasp at times why the one can't be the same as the other.
You know, I was looking at comments from some of your students, Alan, and I want to take this right to Amina Green. It seems to me that young people are really hip to what's going on in Washington in the sense that a lot of people that I see in blogs and in comments really have concluded that people in Washington like it this way. They complain a lot, but they really like this division where nothing gets done. Is that what you're seeing, Amina Green, from Detroit?
Actually, yes, it really is. It's like politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done. It seems like everything each party has, the other party says no, but they don't want to really give any alternatives. It's more of just back and forth bickering between siblings.
And Michael Head, a senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia, how does the Constitution and the way the government works in Washington end up rewarding people who just sort of dig in their heels?
I don't think it really rewards anybody. We don't get anything done. It doesn't benefit us as a country. I think that if we need to be successful in this country, we need to start working together, not be divided. Just like that girl said before me, we need to stop bickering like brothers and sisters and need to get things done.
Well, as a civic student, okay, as a senior at a high school, what in the Constitution is a lever that can be pulled to maybe make some things happen here? And then I'll take it back to the teacher, Alan Broadman, in just a moment. Michael? It's a hard one.
Yeah, it's actually very hard.
Alan Broadman will help us out here.
Yeah, I think there are a number of places, and I think we look generally initially to the concept of what the Constitution is. It starts with we the people, which means it's our government, popular sovereignty. We have a role here to play. We play that through the simple concept, arguably, of elections, where we vote. But we also do that with our freedom of speech and the freedom of press. Okay, our opportunity to participate in government, I think, is the key way for us to attempt to break this logjam.
But if we only participate once every 4 years, Michael Head, do you hear your voice? Do you see your voice being expressed on Capitol Hill at all?
No, like I don't feel like I have any say-so in anything.
So, Amina Green, how about you? Do you have any say-so? Do you see and hear your voice? And if you don't, I suspect both of you need to pull out the pitchforks, right?
Yes, I don't hear my voice being heard. It's just a bunch of loudness everywhere besides, you know, hearing myself. It's just, well, gridlock, and there's nothing going on, so.
All right, now, Alan Broadman, I mean, that level of cynicism after a historic election in 2008 has got to be something of a toxin from your perspective as a teacher who's trying to engage and prepare students to participate in a democracy.
Most assuredly, and that's part of the problem. Unfortunately, the system places both of the two people who've just spoken, both of our students, in a position where their voices are less heard. Why? They don't have a vote.
And
I'm not advocating for a younger vote, but the point is that is part of the frustration level that my students feel as well. Okay, and therefore they have to rely on what are perceived as secondary means of addressing problems, speaking up, okay? But it is a toxin. It does cause a problem. But the key from when I'm teaching this is to say, okay, that's the issue. Now how do we fix that?
All right, Michael Head, are you more or less likely to vote when you can vote in the first presidential election based on what's happened in the last few months?
No, I think I'm more likely to vote.
That's
good. I want to have my say in what happens in this election. It's my nation, too, just like everybody else's, and I want to have a say-so.
Amina Green, more or less likely to vote based on what's happened in the last few months?
More likely, just as he just said, you know, it's my nation, and I have a say-so, so I would like to say who gets in and who doesn't.
All right, well, we got that going for us. Michael Head, senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia, and Amina Green, junior at Detroit School of the Arts, and Alan Broadman, a teacher, taking it home, civics teacher at East Brunswick High School there in New Jersey. Thanks to all of you. Alan Broadman has written more on teaching civics while government is deadlocked. It's on our website now. Go to thetakeaway.org. And our question to you today, what do you think it will take to make the two parties get along on health care? A summit, a compromise on a specific issue,
are independents
just becoming a third party? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can hear the President's Healthcare Summit live at thetakeaway.org at 10 a.m. Eastern Time.
We're going to be talking about technology because it's Thursday, and today we're going to talk a little bit, delve deeper into the case in Italy over the Google executives who were convicted and what that may mean for free speech around the globe. Is there global free speech? We'll talk about it. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Cuba has announced the death of a leading political dissident after a long hunger strike. It's the first death of its kind in Cuba for nearly 40 years. The funeral of the hunger striker Orlando Zapata will be held in a few hours' time. To get more details, we spoke with Marcelo Justo of the BBC's Spanish-American service. He's been following the story, and he told us why Orlando Zapata was on hunger strike.
Well, he was arrested in 2003 with 75 dissidents jailed by the authorities. And first he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Then this was increased to 25 years after he was charged with disobedience and disorder at the prison there in Cuba. And he was basically protesting against all this and against the treatment of prisoners there in Cuba. And it was a very long held protest, 85 days, refusing food. And that eventually led to his death.
He starved to death at the age of 42. I understand that Cuban President Raul Castro made a public statement about this. What was his response?
Exactly. He lamented the death of a detained activist of Orlando Zapata Tamayo, but he said, this is very strange, in general it's a very rare expression of sorrow by the leadership in Cuba, but at the same time he accused the United States of and the tensions between the United States and Cuba of what has happened, saying that without these tensions and because of these tensions, thousands of Cubans had died, and he included Orlando Zapata's death into this group of people who had died due to this tension, this long-held political tension between the United States and Cuba.
So he basically blamed Zapata's death on the United States, but one thing that is notable in Raul Castro's comments is that he actually admitted that there are political prisoners in Cuban jails.
Yeah, well, what he said, what he didn't kind of quite refer to that. What he said in his terms was basically that there were no person had been killed or assassinated by the Cuban forces. No person had been tortured. And he compared the case of Cuba with the situation in the United States and what was happening, he said, in the Cuban state. And he made reference to Guantanamo. He said, not in Cuban territory, because Guantanamo is in Cuban territory, but under United States jurisdiction. And over there, yes, people are assassinated and people are tortured. So in a way, it was a way of recognizing the presence of prisoners of conscience, but at the same time he was saying we don't do anything kind of, you know, against the human rights with them.
Is there expected to be a widespread public response, especially at the funeral of Orlando Zapata today?
Well, there's been a lot of arrests previous to that, according to the opposition group. So probably that has neutralized a bit the possibility of the opposition to express themselves at this funeral. But this funeral will take place within an hour or two, and so we'll see very soon.
That was Marcelo Justo of the BBC's Spanish American Service. He joined us earlier this morning. He was talking about the death of Orlando Zapata, a political dissident that was being held in a Cuban jail. Zapata died after a long hunger strike.
Good morning, John Hockenberry back here with Celeste Headlee. And on our tech segment this Thursday, we're going to talk about whether convictions of Google executives in Italy may have launched a global war on free speech as far as the internet is concerned. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on leading stories. They're coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. Economic news just out. New jobless claims rose unexpectedly last week as businesses boosted layoffs. Also some mixed numbers that are disturbing the markets on the demand for durable goods. Staying on jobs, the Senate yesterday passed a major jobs bill. It would allow businesses tax breaks if they hire the unemployed. And in a little over an hour, President Obama and members of Congress will weigh in on health care reform during a six-hour meeting to be broadcast live on television. We'll be streaming the healthcare meeting live on our website at thetakeaway.org. It kicks off at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, and we want to hear your reactions. Blog live to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
At the Winter Olympics today, if anyone's game with seven medal events, it's anyone's game, I should excuse me, with seven medal events are scheduled. This includes ice hockey, freestyle skating, and more figure skating as well. Yesterday, the U.S. took two bronze medals. One of the winners was U.S. skater Lana Gehring, whose team won a bronze medal after South Korea was disqualified. She says the win was a major achievement.
We train day after day, you know, hours upon hours, and, you know, we deserve that medal for sure.
The U.S. leads the medal count with 28. General Motors says it will discontinue its Hummer SUV after a deal to sell it to a Chinese manufacturer fell through. To get the Chinese perspective on this, we spoke with BBC China editor Shirong Chen. He joined us earlier from London, and he filled us in on why the deal fell through.
I think, first of all, Tendrong failed to get it all passed through the Chinese regulator because the officials, the Chinese government, even though they are eager to get foreign assets like automobiles, but they are not that desperate. And from the very beginning, there's a controversy around whether Hum is a good brand. And some commentators in China are saying for the company to do this acquisition, number one, they don't have the capital. Number two, they don't have the experience. Number three, they don't have the technology. Now you match that with the Hummer. They say, number one, no future. Number two, no market. Number three, no popularity. Apparently, it is sold less than 60 units in China last year. So who would see that deal could come through?
Is there a big market for large trucks and SUVs in China?
Oh, there is a big market, but as people are talking about climate change and green technology, green living, so that market is shrinking. And also, when people talk about U.S. brand, it's no longer the Hummer. Probably the luxury brand rather than the gas guzzling ones.
That was Shirong Chen, China editor for our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So our tech segment this Thursday involves the law, which is a very sort of low-tech operation, but it's also the highest tech of companies around the world, Google. An Italian court yesterday found three Google executives guilty of invasion of privacy because of an offensive video posted to Google Video. The video depicted a boy with Down syndrome being bullied by four teenagers. Google was alerted to it. They took it down. But prosecutors argued that it should never have been allowed on Google Video in the first place. And it violated Italian privacy laws, and therefore Google was liable. Three executives were convicted. Joining us now to talk about this are Jeff Rosen, law professor at George Washington University, and Clive Thompson, tech writer, whose work regularly appears in Wired and the New York Times, and who regularly appears on this show. Now, global companies have standards and practices, people, as a matter of course, in all nations where they operate, gentlemen, to make sure they're complying with the laws and the rules. Clive Thompson, how is this case different?
Well, this one is a little bit different because the EU, you know, had an existing law from several years before that did the same sort of thing it does in the U.S., where it says if there's anyone who's hosting stuff online, like videos or blogs or comments, they're not liable for what's on those sites, so long as if they get a complaint right. about something, they take it down quickly, sort of a safe harbor. And so Google thought that it was going along with the law of the land in the EU, as it does in the U.S. and other countries.
So, Jeff Rosen, first of all, is there any notion, vague or otherwise, of a kind of globally accepted standard of free speech that might be a guide here on the Internet?
There's really not. It's striking that the person who has more control over free speech than any judge or any king is the deputy general counsel of Google. It's a woman called Nicole Wong. She's called the decider. And basically, she's woken up in the middle of the night. She gets calls from the Turkish government, which says that their privacy laws are being invaded because Greek football fans are calling the founder of Turkey gay. Or in Thailand, it's a crime to insult the king. And basically, Google has to comply with local laws, with laws in all the countries in which it operates, because if it doesn't, its employees will be thrown in jail. The only real free speech standard, as Clive suggested, the only global notion is not holding platforms like Google liable for what they post. And in the U.S., that's a clear standard because the Communications Decency Act says that content providers can't be held liable as long as they don't make content decisions. In the EU, there was this broad understanding that there'd be a similar principle applied. But by thwarting that principle, the Italian criminal court has frightened not only Google, but media companies throughout the world, because all of them fear that their employees could be hauled off to jail because of content that other people post.
This is as low-tech as it gets. And this is basically a standard that if I take a libelous poster and put it up on a CBS-owned billboard that happens to be blank, what the Italians have done is said that CBS is liable if they don't take it down, that the prosecutors don't have to come after me. There's no really high technology involved here, except for the fact that Google is this ubiquitous brand that operates everywhere in the world. Clive Thompson, is Google in a position to basically create a template for international law based on its corporate policies around the world?
Well, no. I mean, countries are sovereign and they can do as they will. And Google, as Jeffrey said, often has to work around countries' laws.
But there are precedents that are going to be set here. I mean, if Google plays this badly, the precedents could go one way. If they do it another way, it could go another way.
Well, it is interesting. Some people have speculated that what Italy has done here is sort of shot itself in the foot, because a lot of not just Google, but a lot of internet companies that offer services might think twice about offering that service in Italy. If they have, something, we're going to host tweet-like things, Well, what if someone defames someone else in a tweet that is, hosted by your company in Italy? Are you going to get hauled into court? So the response could be not, Italy, we want you to change your law, but we're just not going to participate. We're not going to play ball in Italy.
Jeff Rosen, is the value of something like Google and just the Internet in general degraded by depending on how this goes, in the sense that if you're broadcasting to the world on some sort of Facebook page, you believe, and that's sort of the product that you're buying, that you're broadcasting to the whole world, when in fact the way this could go is you're actually broadcasting to a bunch of filters that may or may not let your content be seen?
That's a real danger. Obviously, in China, it was very acute, so much so that Google eventually decided they're not going to play anymore. But there is a solution to this, some form of transparency. In Germany, for example, Google has to take down Holocaust denial videos, which are illegal in Germany, although not in the U.S., but they post a link to a public interest website saying, this link has been removed, and if you want to find it, here's the archive. So that, at least, people know that when things are being filtered, they know what they're getting, and then they can make a decision about whether to search on the German Google or the French Google or whatever. That's one sort of solution.
And very quickly, Jeff Rosen, is there a solution here for Google to maybe do it better than maybe having a single decider who gets wakened up in the middle of the night operating this sort of thing?
Google does have a solution they prefer. Nicole Wong says, I can't deal with this. It's too much work. I prefer that democratic countries tell me what to remove. So in Germany, for example, there's a state body that identifies YouTube videos that it wants taken down and notifies Google. Google would prefer that Italy do that too. Italy hasn't done that. But ironically, that solution might protect less speech than Google does right now, because Nicole Wong is actually pretty pro-free speech.
Well, that's really fascinating, a process to replace a gatekeeper there, the powerful Nicole Wong at Google. Jeff Rosen is law professor at George Washington Washington University, and Clive Thompson, tech writer whose work regularly appears on this program and our partner, The New York Times, and in Wired. Thanks so much to both of you.
Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about transportation. It's part of a project with our home station, WNYC, and we're going to look at gas prices and commuting costs and how they're actually tied to the foreclosure crisis. But we need your reporting on this issue. We want you to tell us, how has rising gas prices, maybe bus fares, hit your wallet, and has it affected any other parts of your lifestyle? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And while you're at the website, thetakeaway.org, you can catch up on our series, Frustration Nation and the Problems with Congressional Gridlock.
Politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done.
That's one takeaway from high school civic student Amina Green in Detroit. Listen to more about what she said and the whole series at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
You can hear why she says she's still gonna vote. I'm John Hockenberry. Most hopeful thing I heard all morning. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.